Systems that work do not just happen. They need to be planned, designed, and built. But how do we do that? How do we build a system for human thriving when we are all so different and unique? Let's find out. Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier, healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me.
And Phil Dunwoody, that's me. Neil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Neil, where can people find us?
Thank you so much for asking. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and also LinkedIn. And you can reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com with any questions or comments.
All right, so today's episode is the big reveal. I feel like we need a drum roll.
Right.
You know.
Love it.
So we have been throughout the podcast so far hitting essentially each of the eight topics that Neil and I cover in this class. And so we are calling this episode, our kind of eight ways of well-being. This is the Thriveology Lab system. And the opening quote is from a 2018 article, A Systems Approach to Healthcare, From Thinking to Practice. And, you know, this is the kind of the overarching framework that we use to teach the class that we're using for this podcast. So what, you know, just one way of thinking about this is, and certainly how Neil and I have approached this is kind of, why are we doing this in a way? Mm-hmm. What was the problem we were trying to solve? Because I think you and I have really came to this very kind of functionally, both in our own lives, but also right. Our students and our friends and colleagues and whatnot.
Well, one of the things we keep talking about is how, you know, the modern world has been engineered in a way that has taken us very far away from our evolutionary ancestral practices. Mm-hmm. And now, despite even having, at least in America and in the West, sort of great material wealth, we have epidemic levels of anxiety, depression, chronic diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, most cancers. And we tend in the sort of healthcare system, and much of the way we think of mental illness is from a top-down symptomatic approach rather than a functional systematic approach. And so we're trying to treat things at the top, but not really getting to its root causes. They're quick fixes. They're sort of from a McDonald's culture. Like, we want it fast. We want a quick pill. Let me just get in, get out, and be done with it. And as we even talked about in episode one, we see so many of our friends, our students, our colleagues struggling with well-being. And even if they're – I always keep turning to the sociologist Corey Keyes's term languishing. And so I think particularly out of the pandemic, people – even if you weren't sort of full-on depressed, full-on burnout, full-on – and we see full-on but even if that wasn't the case – this sense of languishing, like I'm just not living as fully as I feel like I could be. It seemed like everybody was struggling, right? And still mm-hmm. doing so many years later. And the fact is we're not taught in schools how to thrive. I was listening, what was it? I think it was an Alan Watts lecture.
Love Alan Watts.
Oh, I love him. And he was talking about, I think the word is grados. In Greek, grados, like steps, grados. So even like grades, like first grade, second grade, third grade, they're all about like getting to the next step. And then you graduate, which is another step. And then you get all those steps done. You're like, well, now what? And so at no point were you sort of like, how do you just live well? That's it's not part of our teachings in those cases.
I mean, you know, some of these things are to some extent common sense. That, you know, you've probably seen this. I've seen this meme pop up on like Facebook or Instagram where someone's like, you know, I don't know why I just feel so down and depressed. And the other person's like, well, did you sleep well? No. Have you eaten? No. Right. Have you gone outside? No. Have you exercised? No. You know, there's so much truth to that, though, in terms of the amount of ultra-processed foods that we eat, the lack of exercise, the lack of going outside, the lack of socialization, that is, to some extent, normal. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, well, let's be deliberate about thinking about that and thinking about the effect on our well-being instead of just letting it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so this is really where you and I have come to with the model in seeing these struggles. And as you point out, as a society, we tend to treat symptoms like, oh, well, you know, you've got this issue. Well, here's a pill for that. And not to say I'm anti-pill. Their pills right. can be wonderful for certain things. But often there are, you know, this is this functional approach, this systems approach. There are root causes. And that, I think, is really what we are trying to address with the model.
Right.
Right. When you build strong social networks, when you get a good night's sleep, when you have a good diet, all of these things actually build resilience so that you're less likely to have anxiety, depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, rather than just treating the symptom, which, again, sometimes you need to do.
Right.
Right. But to say let's actually prioritize the overall health, wellness, flourishing. Okay. So we're calling this our Thriveology model. I talk a lot in my psychology classes about what is a model. I teach research methods, and what we do in science is we build models. And scientists use the term model interchangeably with theory. So if you say we have a theory of gravity, or a theory of evolution, or a theory of the structure of DNA, you could also say we have a model of evolution, a model of gravity, model of you know, the helical structure of DNA. All of these, a model is simply a way of saying there's something in the world that we're trying to explain, and we're going to describe how we think it works as best we can. Sometimes it's a physical thing, like a map of a geographical location is a model. You know, sometimes it's a two-dimensional model as in the form of a map, but, you know, if you grew up playing with trains or something, you might have had a 3D, you right. know, kind of train thing you were building. You know, I think of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, you know, and make-believe land. So this is what we do. We build models of scientists, and then we essentially we collect data to see how well our observations match with what the model would predict. So we have, for example, models of working memory and attention. And as we collect more and more data, we refine the models so that they're more and more accurate at kind of predicting the data. And that helps us think that we've got a good model. Now, when we're talking about something physical, let's say like the model of how the endocrine system works, there is, you know, perhaps this thing out there in the physical world. We're talking about a social model or a social psychological model that it's not like a model of, you know, let's say gravity, which is just this thing in the world, but more there's a sense of our own values are wrapped up in this,
mm-hmm.
right? What is flourishing? What is well-being? Well, to some extent, that is up to us to decide. And so it's not as objective as kind of creating a model of the standalone thing, but it's more, what do we think should be valued? And yes, what does the research say? Of course, but there's definitely some sense of our own values that go into constructing a model like this.
And I love your use of map, and so as a synonym, if you will, for a model, like a map, that just gives me a really good visualization, because like a map is not the thing. A map is not, you know, the map to Las Vegas is not Las Vegas, and to some degree it's deliberately, it has to by its very nature exclude a lot of the nuance of the real world, because it's been reduced to this sort of practical tool. And that's sort of what our model is. We're not saying this is an exhaustive list of all the things, but they're salient aspects that you and I keep coming back and keep seeing in our students and our colleagues and our own lives, that seemed like if we at least did these eight and really worked on them, we'd be a heck of a lot farther along toward some model of thriving.
Yeah, no, the point you make is a good one, that all models are imperfect. There's this saying out of statistics that I really enjoy it comes from, or at least it's attributed to British statistician George Box. All models are wrong, but some models are useful. and that's, I think, as science, you know, there is this sense sometimes like, well, I'm discovering truth with a capital T. And I tell my students, no, we're discovering truth with a small t, because it's truth that can always be revised. Mm-hmm. In other words, we never stop revising our models in science. This is kind of what differentiates what you might say religious beliefs from scientific beliefs. In scientific beliefs, we say, we think this is true for now, but we might update it later. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that you have to have some comfort with ambiguity and whatnot to live in that world, but that's what we do.
And I think you and I are both also tinkerers by nature. And so, yes, like getting in and like, what does this piece and this piece do and all these different pieces? And maybe there's a piece we're missing. And
So all these things. So for us, these are, you know, how did these things get in our model, which we're still, the big reveal is almost moments away. But these are things that come from our own reading, our own research, and really this kind of emerging field in positive psychology now about kind of human flourishing and well-being. And, of course, the long philosophy tradition on human flourishing. So these are not just things that you and I have made up, right? And I think the way to think about the way at least, you know, to think about the things in the model, if I think what are we trying to predict or explain, it is to some extent something we talked about before, subjective well-being, which you could define it in a number of ways. A common way that is measured is to say life satisfaction, frequent positive affect, which means, you know, good mood experiences, and infrequent negative affect, which is everyone has down days and sad moments and things happen. But in general, you're satisfied with your life. You feel relatively content. And relatively happy, though you and I have not stressed happiness as we've talked throughout this. And I think at some point we probably should do a podcast episode on, you know, what is the difference between happiness and well-being? Because I think well-being, we're talking about a much broader construct.
Well, I think you flagged a really important word, this idea of contentment.
Yeah.
That contentment for me, if I'm living this model effectively, is more resilient than the ups and downs of happiness, sadness, good days, bad days.
Yeah.
I am more stably content with my life and how it's going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one way then to think of kind of this model, our model of human thriving, is that thriving is this emergent property. We're not saying there's only one of these eight things. These eight things interact. We're viewing this as a system. So mindfulness is one of the things we've talked about. You know, living mindfully allows you to focus on the other things in the model. You know, being well rested because you sleep allows you to act more mindfully. So it's not any one of these things. You could think of individual researchers who have expertise in these things, kind of like medical specialists. And in a way, what you and I act as is more the general practitioner, where we're connecting all those dots and saying, okay, how is the system connected? And let's talk about the overall health, well-being of the organism.
Maybe just for folks who might not know, maybe just do a quick tap on like what emergence is, what a like systems
is. Yeah, go for
it. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, emergence is sort of this broad umbrella category for the observation of behaviors that come out that seem more complicated than the inputs below them. So consider like a colony of ants. So like no ant is having some grand thought about building some, you know, tunnel structure. And yet a colony of ants builds this thing that seems almost impossible, or like there's no thought that's in a single neuron, but you put a billion neurons together and suddenly you've got the Mona Lisa. Like how that something emerges out of the interplay between all the other elements below it. And that's where I think this systems approach is so important, because we're not saying like it might be turning the dial on one of these things is a huge shift for you, but it might just be that like little tweaks across the whole model allow for the emergence of something even more potent because of the complex interplay. And sometimes that interplay is hard to like pinpoint because it almost has, again, we want to be very evidence-based, but it almost feels magical. Like mm-hmm. how ants work seems like magic.
When we talk about consciousness as an emergent yep. property, there's no one thing, there's no one spot in the brain you can say, oh, this is the consciousness bundle of neurons. You know, and even as our kind of ability to map the human brain through neuroscience has taken off tremendously, we do have a better understanding of kind of what area, you know, this is the map, what areas of the brain light up and are involved in conscious functions. But that's not to say that we can fully explain consciousness. We can't. It is an emergent property of the system, this incredibly complex system.
Yep.
All right.
So we doing it?
Drum roll. All right, Neil.
Okay. So here it is. Here is the 8 ways of well-being for the Thriveology lab system. Act mindfully, live your values, eat whole foods, do hard things outside with people, enjoy leisure, and sleep like a baby. There it is.
And so three things would be easier to remember, but it's just we couldn't condense it to 3 things.
But it is, you know, what I love about it, and maybe, you know, I think you and I both love models and love thinking about how things fit together and like puzzle pieces. Thinking of, so it's intended to be a long sentence, but a sentence. And that is so because there is no one thing, there's not a hierarchy. One thing is not more important, although they do, they all sort of feed into one another as a whole. Because they're not these separate, distinct things. I would say that sort of mindfulness does sort of go through all of these. Well, they all go through all of them, right? That's the point of a system. But, that was the point, I think, of framing it in this way.
Just real quick. Like, so act mindfully. The mindful practice allows you to be more aware of your values in daily life. It allows you to maybe be more deliberate and less reactive in your eating tendencies. When you're going to do hard things and you notice maybe some sense of backing away or complacency, you're more aware of that thought process. You can go through all of these things essentially more deliberately with a mindfulness practice. And that's just pick one of them. I mentioned sleep before. I know that when I am sleep deprived, I am less likely to be living my values, less likely to be eating well. I'm not going to push myself the same way, right? So this is what we mean by a systems approach, this interplay, how things are interconnected. And it's no one thing, but yes, I think you and I would say mindfulness is a thread that in particular for us, if we say what is the strongest thread? It might be mindfulness.
Yeah. Well, and I think, again, as a sentence, as a sort of complete thing. I also think of it like sort of like a river. And so when everything's working well, the river just flows through, mm-hmm. keeps flowing through. But then you throw a rock in there and it ripples. It causes these ripples and another causes a ripple. So if I don't get a good night's sleep, as you said, so I'm more likely to eat poorly. I'm less likely to do hard things. I probably won't be acting very mindfully. So I threw this rock in my sleep and it rippled out to the other things.
That's a great analogy.
If I don't eat well, it throws a rock in and it ripples out to these other things. So all of them are all interconnected in that way.
So what we're going to do now is relatively briefly go through each of the 8. We're going to reference the previous Thriveology Lab episodes that cover this topic. We're going to hit just one quick topic that we covered within each of those. And then Neil and I are going to essentially like reflection. We're just out of the new year coming into 2025. I think that is a good time always for reflection. As we've been doing this podcast, as you and I have been teaching this class for years, we have kind of continuously been reflecting and refining these things. And so we'll do a little bit some of our takeaways related to the episode and what parts of it have stuck with us personally.
Sweet. So part 1 is act mindfully, right? And so that comes from episodes 2 and 3. And one of the most salient key findings comes from a randomized controlled trial of KORU, KORU is a mindfulness program for college students and emerging adults, started by a bunch of people, including our friend Holly Rogers, initially out of Duke. But their study showed that even just a four-week and KORU is a sort of systematic approach to mindfulness, that sort of stepwise introduction to different aspects of mindfulness. But their 4 weeks show decreases in perceived stress and sleep problems, increases in mindfulness and self-compassion. And those differences occurred in the mindfulness group, but not the waitlist group, until the waitlist group participated in the program, and then they showed up there as well. So, you know, just – and that's, I think, you know, just – 4 weeks, right?
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
If you could change perceived stress, sleep problems in 4 weeks with, you know, a relatively, you know, Mishija would say 12 minutes a day, you know, 12 minutes a day for 4 weeks, that's those are profound findings.
Yeah, and that have been pretty well replicated.
Replicated, yeah. So. And I, you know, for me, you and I both have fairly regular, sometimes more, sometimes less regular mindfulness practices, you know, in those rocks in the river, ripples out. But like, I'm always struck by, we chatted in one of those episodes about the vagus nerve, which sort of, you know, comes from the brain down. All vagus is Latin for wandering, right? It's where we get vagabond. And so this nerve goes all through all these organs, and it's sort of this information relay system to regulate the sort of autonomic nervous system. And we often think that so much of the autonomic nervous system is out of our control, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. And through breath work and mindfulness to reduce that stress, we can actively intercept some of those signals and calm the system down. And it helps everything from digestion to sleep. It just and that's that, I think, is for me a big takeaway. Like, if I'm feeling stressed, if I'm feeling burnt out or whatever, there is something I can practically do right now.
Yeah, that's a big one. And it's, you know, mindfulness has almost become ubiquitous. It's got so much attention. Mm-hmm. It, you know, I think it is necessary to at least hedge a little bit against the idea that it's a panacea that can fix everything, because it has become so popular.
Sure.
In the corporate world and everywhere that, you know, it gets a little bit of a bad rap. So there's some amount of pushback because of that, and I totally get that. But on the other hand, we know the literature says it improves attention, memory, reduces stress, sleep problems, and increases your well-being and compassion. Like, that's an evidence-based list. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
And that's lot. Impressive. And yeah, and yeah, it that can come from 10 to 15 minutes a day of daily practice. One of the takeaways for me as my own mindfulness practice, you know, has evolved over the years, is this idea that attention is a gift. Mm-hmm. And both to myself and to others. When I'm talking with you, when I'm talking with my students, one of the greatest gift I can give them is actually to be present, to hear them, to see them. And then for myself, when I'm walking, you know, I walked here to record this session today. And for about half the walk, I was pretty distracted. I've got a lot of stuff bouncing around in my head. And I was trying to remind myself, this is part of my practice, to notice that we actually have some blue sky today, which, you know, in central Pennsylvania in the winter, we don't always get a lot of.
Right.
But to be present, right? To breathe, to enjoy the moment, to have some gratitude. So that gift to myself, that gift to others, is something that I think we all need to be reminded of, and it is, for me, it is one of the jewels that I get out of a mindfulness practice, and one of the reasons I like to share it. So, okay, the next topic we covered was live your values. This one, Neil and I did 3 episodes on. This was episodes 10, 11, and 12, and there was just so much here, because there was this big picture sense of what is purpose? What is meaning, like, at this, you know, 20,000 foot level? There's, of course, the research on it. And then we got into kind of habits and how do you, you know, if I do want to live more in alignment with my purpose, my goals, well, first I have to figure out, do I know what my purpose is? I have to have some way of tuning in with that. Again, for me, that's part of that is mindfulness and in being centered enough to know what feels true, what rings true. But then also knowing something about habits and how to construct my life in a deliberate way that helps me achieve my goals that are in line with that purpose. And this is something you and I've talked a bit about, this difference between values and goals. One of the key studies that we reviewed, we did lots in those three episodes, but it's called Sense of Purpose as a Psychological Resource for Aging and Well-Being. It's from the Journal of Developmental Psychology. It's a 2015 publication. This is a sample of over 1,400 older adults. And participants who scored higher on Sense of Purpose reported lower levels of functional disability, better performance on cognitive tests, better self-rated health, and fewer depressive symptoms. Higher Sense of Purpose was also associated with increased probability of survival. And that's, you know, I mean, again, there's a lot, you kind of like mindfulness, there's a lot packed into just this one example of what living a life that feels purposeful, what kind of difference that could actually make in your life. It's big.
It's big. And I think a lot of people, we see this a lot with our students, we feel like we know who we are, but yet we haven't done a really detailed inventory to say, like, wait, what do I actually? And the practice of being able to actively say it in words, put it down on paper, like, these are the things I value, this is my purpose, has a profound shift for people, because it suddenly sort of concretizes just the sort of nebulous stuff out in the ether. It's like, oh, that's who I am. Mm-hmm. And once I sort of have that cleared, it's not that I can't change it, or like maybe the words don't quite resonate with me, but having that, like, I think of like Plato's Apology, the unexamined life is not worth living. And what I take away from that is, like, we have to do this inventory of ourselves and our values such that we can truly live that life. And I often think that often leads then to a sense of accountability. Once I know what it is I'm supposed to be doing, then I can be accountable to myself. And I know, like, oh, I wasn't really living in alignment with my values. That's probably where that anxiety was coming from, because I know this is not the right path for me. Instead of responsibility, but responsibility, because it gives us the ability to respond to something rather than simply react.
I like that. It reminds me of, we talked in that episode about Martha Beck's work on integrity. And I think, and I feel this regularly, this kind of sense of, I should be doing this. And, you know, and some opportunity comes up and I get excited about it. And I have started to ask myself more and more, am I getting excited about this because I've been conditioned by society to think this is what good people do, and it's the next thing I should be doing, or is this something that really resonates kind of deeply with my own goals, my sense of purpose, meaning, values? I think that discernment sometimes is not so easy, actually, and it does take some reflection. One of the other things I was struck by in those episodes, I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is a classic work, but I had never read before this. And, you know, his whole focus on kind of psychotherapy is to say we are meaning-seeking. That is the essence of humanity, is to find meaning and purpose. And he talks about in the concentration camps. He is a Holocaust survivor, that's a lot of what the book is about. But he talks quite explicitly about having a sense of purpose and how that helped you survive those horrors, and that he could see as soon as people gave that up, as soon as they lost the will to live, you knew it wasn't going to be long, essentially, until that person was gone. And so there was that, but then there was also the literature we discussed, which one of them we just mentioned a moment ago, showing that having a sense of purpose does actually increase your the research. It, It may have some effect on actual longevity. It clearly has an effect on quality of life. Mm. Right? And so those are big. The whole less but better idea I like. And
I do too. Yeah.
But it's also forced me to think about what my goals actually are. Mm-hmm. I think I have a tendency to take on too many things. And then I'm not moving forward in any one thing. And all of them, and this might be the difference between values and goals, all of them I would say are consistent with my values. If I set goals, I'm in a way I'm forced to prioritize mm-hmm. which things are actually most important. And I'm saying I want to move forward on these things. And that offers that sense of accountability, right?
Yeah, and I'm reading a book by Michael Beckwith right now called Life Visioning, and he might argue that, you know, ego gets in the way sometimes. Like our ego, because I do too. I think many of us say yes to a whole bunch of things because it speaks to our ego. This is about advancement . But I think, you know, the two most powerful words in any language are yes and no. Yeah. As you set things off into motion, into the universe, or you cause a stop to them. But so often we throw those magic words around without that discernment that you're talking about, mm-hmm. Taking a pause to say, am I saying yes? Am I saying no to this? And why?
Yeah. What will the consequences be for my goals, right? For the things that I do want to achieve going forward.
So next in the model is eat whole foods. This comes from episodes 4 and 5. And the key finding here, this comes from a randomized trial that shows the impact of nutrition as a treatment for depression. And I think this was really meaningful to both of us, really sort of revealing how much the emerging field of nutritional psychiatry is really causing a lot of these connections to be paid attention to. This is a 12-week study, included 7 home visits. Participants were randomly assigned to either receive visits from a dietitian who worked with them to improve their diet or someone just simply doing emotional support. And the dietary support group showed a significant decrease in depression scores compared to the social support control with a large effect size. Depression remission were reported in 32% of the dietary support group compared to only 8% in the emotional support group. 32 versus 8.
Yeah, this study was not just impactful for you and I. It was apparently the first randomized trial treating depression through diet. And it was published in 2017. So this is, you know, by the way science moves, this is hot off the press, right?
Yeah,
this is really recent, called the SMILES trials. And yeah, I was blown away by this. And of course, the fact that how much this is replicated, and even, you know, my younger son has been home over college break. And of course, I'm harassing him a little bit about his diet because I can see he's started to eat more ultra processed foods. Mm. You know, he's living a college student life, and I've you know, just tried to get him to reflect and talked about, like, actually, geez, that puts you at risk for all kinds of things. Really try and focus on whole foods as the main source of your diet.
And I remember, like, when we just came out of sort of a ketogenic diet phase where it was all the rage, everybody was doing keto, but there was a lot connected with there was a bunch of psychiatrists using keto as a way to treat some of this, and they were getting initially a lot of pushback saying, like, oh, you just can't, that's, you can't say food is going to fix this thing. Like, we have a lot of hang-ups, I think, culturally with food, how we think of food, what we think food is or can do. And so I'm so happy that more and more of these studies are coming to the surface to show that, yeah, like, that old adage, what you eat is kind of true.
So true.
I think one of the things that really keeps sticking out to me from those episodes, like, we so often talk about sort of mental health, thinking it's just brain health, and thinking about how food is fueling this whole system, and that the health of the system is so relevant, whether we're talking about just what gets into our bloodstream, but what also feeds our microbiome, what like all these connective fibers to this.
Yeah, and this is for a, you know, I mean, for as long as I've been teaching psychology, I've tried to break down in my students the notion that there's often this question, well, is it real, meaning is it physical, or is it just in your head?
Right.
And this idea that everything that happens in your head is also physical, right? There are neurons at work here, neurotransmitters. But I think this research in particular really highlighted that you know, a diet that causes inflammation in the body, well, guess what? Your brain is part of your body. It's going to cause inflammation in the brain. And guess what? That's associated with depression. One of the big, you know, I think I knew this at some level, but going over the two episodes, so the whole nutritional psychiatry movement was something I wasn't aware of until we dove into this. And so that was a big takeaway, is like, oh, wow, so science is really kind of validating this, and it's becoming a, for at least a certain number of medical practitioners, I'll say a diet-first approach to treating mental health, which I think is fascinating. The flip side of that, to some extent, is thinking of how did we get here?
Mm-hmm.
And over a pretty short period of time, you know, I'm going to say 50 years, I'm calling short, maybe that's long, ultra-processed foods have become, for many people, the main part of what they eat, that, you know, the majority of their diet. And the research just makes so clear that they are really, really bad for your health and should be reserved for kind of emergency purposes, now and then things. And so, yeah, some of my, I'll say, very basic takeaways from this are avoid ultra processed foods like the plague, and go with a Mediterranean diet, lots of olive oil, fish, and the research says that actually makes a huge difference. I was surprised by just how well evidence-based the Mediterranean diet's been around a long time. I have often eaten a Mediterranean type diet, I wasn't that aware of the research, and the research is impressive.
And I think that the ubiquity of those ultra-processed foods it's so pervasive that one of the first things I do, and another class I do, it teaches Fit Lab, and it's sort of ways of well-being light class, yeah, if you will. But one of the things we do is sort of get students to even start thinking about, like, how do I even identify an ultra-processed food? And so we'll ask them, like how do you make ketchup? And they'll say, oh, it's like three ingredients, right? But then you look at like the back of a bottle of ketchup from the store, and it's got like, you know, 15, 20 different things. Some of them you can't even pronounce. It's like, well, that probably shouldn't be going into your body.
Right.
Speaking of sort of doing hard things, do hard things is the next part of the model. And this comes from episode 6. And, you know, a major takeaway from here us was that doing hard things has a very real impact on brain health, in particular on all kinds of things in the system, but particularly brain health, in particularly regarding the AMCC, or the anterior mid cingulate cortex, which is part of the larger cingulate cortex structure. And the AMCC has a number of sort of responsibilities, partially in response to threat detection. So it's sort of evaluating threat out in the world, and then helping recruit different resources to deal with that threat. And what a lot of scientists are now linking that to is this sense of tenacity, your ability to stick with it, your ability to sort of endure hardship. And one of the things I actually found was that when you actively seek out, not just you have a tough life and bad things happen to you, but you actively go to it, seeking it, doing things like a diet, doing things like hard workouts first thing in the morning, actually light up the AMCC and actually make it stronger. They make it bigger and stronger. And there was a I'm trying to find this study quote in here, but like there was one study, and this is trigger warning, to talk about handguns a little bit, but just like, even if I if scientists showed just a picture of someone holding a handgun just in their hand versus a picture of a gun pointed to the person seeing the picture, even just that picture, the brain evaluates the second, the latter, as a threat. And so I'm not advocating people go out and like even have handguns for that matter, but even like seek out that kind of threat. But like, one of the things we do on the Ways of Well-Being trip to Costa Rica, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, very excited,
yay,
is we go rappelling down waterfalls. And so it's often scary. It's a challenging physical activity because you got water rushing down, you've got ropes to manage, you can't really see where you're going. But seeking those things out, actively doing them, bolsters this sense of tenacity, your ability of your sense of self-efficacy in the world, your ability to overcome these things, so much so that scientists are now saying the AMCC may be directly responsible to our will to live.
Yeah, I was really struck by that.
Like, if you want to, like, again, it's a system, so it's probably not that simple. Anytime people say that's the thing, I'm like, well, it's probably not just that, but
it's involved.
Yeah, so I'm just and I know for myself, sometimes, you know, I feel the gravitational pull so often in my life of just wanting to sit on the couch and watch Netflix,
mm-hmm.
right? That I feel that pull so keenly that I found that I have to deliberately put myself in a kind of, I'm putting air quotes here, harm's way to seek out those kinds of hardship, because I know without that intentionality, I will avoid them like the plague.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I deliberately go to the gym first thing in the morning because it's really hard for me to get out of bed and go do that. But the more I do it, the more I feel this, like, okay, I can do hard things. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, particularly for us as teachers, a sense to cultivate in our students that their ability, you can do hard things, that's really significant.
Yeah, I mean, I my takeaway was essentially the same as this idea that doing hard things makes it easier to do hard things.
Yeah.
But the reverse is that, you know, being complacent makes it easier to be complacent. And so the sense of kind of constantly having to challenge yourself and I think often seek out maybe new challenges and ways to push yourself and grow, that really is good for your health, right? Essentially good for this will to live. And it is discipline. You know, if I have to get something done that I don't really want to do, let's say for part of my job, right, having a habit of doing it makes it easier for me to like, okay, I can sit down and bang this out.
Yep.
Right. And so we all have to do things in life we don't necessarily want to do at times. Having this habit of pushing yourself just makes it easier to push through when you need to. It's a relatively simple idea, but it's powerful, and it was neat to me to see the research behind it at a physiological level, talking about this AMCC. You know, it's this whole Aristotle idea that, you know, you become ethical by practicing your ethics, right? And in a way, you become disciplined by practicing discipline. I mean, yeah. It's simple and circular, but it also makes sense because you're essentially – those neural circuits are wiring a little bit deeper, and yeah, your that will to live, right? The perseverance part of you is getting stronger by pushing.
And that just goes back again, like, our world has been engineered to take a lot of hardship out of it. Most of us don't have to hunt or farm for our own food. Most of us don't have to like walk great distances to places. Most of us don't have to lift heavy things if we don't want to. Like, that's modern life is very sort of like what was the Pixar movie with the robot? Wall-E. Where like, yeah. They've just met these robots doing all their work, and they've just sort of, you know.
And I think we're seeing some of the consequences that then even minor asks seem really difficult and challenging because the in a way the bar has been set so low.
Mm-hmm.
right? So we've gotten soft, you might say. Okay, so the next one, the next part of our model is time outside, being outside. And there were there was so much research in this that was fascinating. Just to summarize some of what the research so shows, rather than talk about one specific study, spending more time outside has been shown to reduce stress and anxiety, improve mood, enhance attention and concentration, boost creativity and problem solving, lower the risk of mental illness, improve cardiovascular health and immune system function. And it's not because you're exercising. It's literally just because you're outside. That's the whole forest bathing stuff, and promote better sleep. It, like so many things, like that's a wow list of items.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, for those playing along at home, like, As we start accumulating all these things, you start hearing these echoes like this does that, that does that. What if I tweaked all of those? I really sort of dialed all of those in. What would be the cumulative effect of that? Pretty great, I'm guessing, right? Yeah. And like for me, I think for both of us, you know, being outside is so important. Mm-hmm. I think I am probably a little more. I have a narrower window of my outside, my environmental enjoyment. I prefer sun, salt, water, and sand, my three S's. And I was always struck by Wallace Nichols' book, Blue Mind, where he talks about how being in, on, and around water can have profound mental and physical health impacts, but particularly for, you know, reducing anxiety, depression, and elevating your mood.
Yeah. Yeah. This episode was very validating for me because it has been for a long time, like my mental health go-to is time outside when I'm stressed, when I'm feeling down. I'm like, let me just go outside and go for a walk. Mm. Like I know by the end of that walk, it's not like all my problems are going to go away, but I will feel better. And even it's part of why I walk to work daily, just that little bit, you know, if for no other time I'm outside. And I always have to take the dogs out. So there's always some other time. But, you know, that's 15 minutes each way. I get that 30 minutes. So I love this biophilia idea that it's this evolutionary base that so much we've talked about in our model that we have evolved essentially to function best in an outdoor environment. And taking us out of that is what actually causes a dysregulation. So we framed it as like, oh, spending time in nature has all these good effects. The other way to frame it is spending time inside door, right? Yeah. Actually has all these negative effects because outside you could argue should be our default
yeah.
environment.
Yeah.
And I love the forest bathing in kind of both Japan and South Korea, that is actually something that is prescribed by doctors. Again, because there's enough empirical evidence that like, oh yeah, you should spend 20 minutes a day outside. I'm writing you a script. Make sure you do this. That's a wonderful idea.
Well, no, when we take the students down to Costa Rica, we're only indoors really to sleep.
Yeah.
Even like, you know, when we're having meals, they're open air, right? So even the dining room is open air situation. So you're almost constantly outside, and you know it's not an empirical study, but you can see it anecdotally. I can see it in the students' facial expression, their body, like everything. They just, by midweek, they just look like different people. They're brighter, happier people. And I can't help but think, yeah, outdoors is a major contributor
and
to that.
And that is where the climate makes a difference.
Sure.
Right? I mean, right now it's very windy and like 31 degrees outside. So with the wind chill, it's probably 20 feel.
Yeah.
You know, you have to – you're not just going to sit around. you know, if you're going outside now, you're going to have to exercise and work to keep your core up.
Okay. Outside then with real people, with people. We find purpose and value with others. We, again, evolutionary model, right? We evolved in tribal communities. Modern life has engineered a lot of that out of. We made it sort of social media rather than just actual social lives. And I, always struck by Sebastian Younger's book, Tribe. As a journalist, he looks at particularly sort of soldiers, but looked at historical observations of these sort of tribal communities. And he writes, human beings need three basic things in order to be content. They need to feel competent in what they do. They need to feel authentic in their lives, and they need to feel connected to others. These values are considered intrinsic to human happiness and far outweigh extrinsic values such as beauty, money, and status. And in every model that we have looked at, that I have looked at, seen, includes some component of relationships as foundational. Some of the other components vary, different, but you almost always see something about community relationships as part of that. And that, you know, like nutrition, it's not just quantity, but quality of those relationships. And so I think, you know, the standard is always like, if you have somebody you could call at 2 a.m. with an emergency and you know they'd answer, that sense of trust and connectedness is a powerful powerful tool in our lives.
Yeah, it's back to that, you know, we are social beings. Again, you think about it evolutionarily, we evolved to survive in a tribe, in a group. That's what we're wired for. It helps us regulate. I've been aware of this for a long time, all these kind of risk factors of spending too much time alone in terms of your own health and well-being. I think this, for me, it is, and this is a reflection I've been kind of engaging in for a long time, is that it's easy to take others for granted and not get enough of that social time. And this is the way our society has changed too. You know, there's kind of a lot of documentation on how we are more isolated. There used to be bowling clubs, not that there still aren't, right? Bowling teams, but things like that, where we did things in community much more often than we do today. And kind of not only the effect that has on us individually in terms of our well-being, but also as a society and our ability to function together. So I think, yeah, we should look for opportunities to spend positive time with other people and practice more gratitude for the gift of other people in our lives. So the next topic in our model is enjoy leisure, right? So leisure activities. And we talked about, we talked about leisure, how it was, you know, play. We talked about sport as part of that. And looking over kind of big picture, all of that research, regular leisure improves well-being by somewhere between 10 and 30%, depending on how you measure well-being. And 10 to 30% is a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is, I think, I'll give my reflection here and then we'll turn to you. We, as a society, are so productivity-oriented and busy-oriented. Those are things we hold up as almost badges of honor of kind of look how busy I am. And we don't recognize the value of leisure in terms of and I don't just mean kind of the quality of our life outside of work, but even at work. The fact that I'm going to be more productive, I'm going to be more creative. We discussed a lot of this in the podcast episode. If I have leisure time to recharge, reboot, play, be creative, that's going to benefit all aspects of my life, including those that fall under that productivity realm that are actually what's now pushing leisure out.
And when we were and we've tinkered over the years that we've been working together, this model has sort of evolved and grown. And when we were initially sort of putting pen to paper, this wasn't in there. And you really challenged me on that and sort of wanted this included. And I'm so happy that you did. But I think the very fact that I didn't think that it ought to be in here initially was directly what you're saying, that we're just so conditioned to think it's work, it's productivity. And we think like I also had it so associated. My purpose was about that sort of forward moving, achieving, and
goal oriented.
And yeah, there's certainly a place for goals, and achievement does feel good. And it's part of a sense of well-being, but it's only a part of that larger system. And having that downtime, that rest time, that rejuvenating, those hobbies, those activities that are also linked to our values are so important. And, you know, and it was so, you know, is that sort of when you sort of pushed for that, it became sort of this light switch for me, because like even like the class we teach, we go down to Costa Rica, and one of the things we go down to do is surf. Surf has absolutely no productive value, right? You're just a splat. You just, you go out in the water, you ride a wave in, you turn around, you do it again. Like, what do you like? But it's so, so much fun and offers so much pleasure, and it's connecting with other people in nature. It's physical, it's all of these things, and it's completely worthless. And that's important. And that's important.
It is important.
And finally, sleep like a baby. This is a quote that we used at the top of episode 14. Many people are surprised to learn that researchers have discovered a single treatment that improves memory, increases people's ability to concentrate, strengthens the immune system, and decreases people's risk of being killed in accidents. Sound too good to be true? It gets even better. The treatment is completely free and has no side effects. Finally, most people would consider the treatment highly enjoyable. Would you try it? And that comes from the 2014 summary, More Sleep Would Make Us Happier, Healthier, and Safer. And, you know, as I mentioned to you in that episode and elsewhere, like in my 20s and 30s, I was definitely someone, this goes back to that productivity thing, that burned the candle at both ends. I was trying to have a super robust social life and a super productive academic life and work life and all these things. And I'll sleep when I'm dead. I'll just, that'll be later. But when I reflect back on those years of how chronically grumpy I was, how sort of run down I always felt, and I just thought, you know, I'm just going to keep muscling through it. Well, of course, you're supposed to be tired and grumpy. You're working really hard. Well, that's sleep when you're dead. You might get dead faster if you don't.
Well, that's what the research shows, unfortunately. I mean, that was one of my takeaways when I read Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, you know, not long after it came out, was this sense of basic metabolic function, which basically involves just cellular repair, regeneration, keeping your body working, is hugely expensive, and most of it happens when you sleep. And so shorting yourself on sleep is actually shorting every biological system that repairs and keeps you functioning. And so again, I think it comes back to, again, our society's focus on busyness and productivity and stress, right? This is, we've talked about, we're going to do an episode on kind of burnout and stress. But so many of us are chronically stressed at a level that is really unhealthy, that impairs our sleep, impairs our functioning, and we really don't recognize the toll that that's taking on us. So again, kind of prioritizing that sleep, rest, rejuvenation, it just makes everything in life seem just a little bit easier. All right. So that is our model in a nutshell, this act mindfully, live your values, eat whole food, do hard things outside with people, enjoy leisure, and then sleep like a baby. And this is when you can, when, you know, this is what you and I do on the retreat that we bring students to. We do a week of this. And more so than, I'll say, in it, at least I won't speak for you, but more so than in my daily life, I try and do this in my daily life as well, but it's easier when you go to a well-being retreat where that is actually the focus. That is the priority.
And I think we'll do another episode on retreats. Yes. The next episode, in fact. But that I think is one of the benefits is like you can do these things more explicitly in a controlled environment. And then you can see like, wow, I could, if I take some of this back, I might not be able to take the thing wholesale back, but if I could take parts of this back and tweak that a little bit in my daily life, I could inch forward to a more thriving life.
Yeah. All right. So the challenge. So this is a different one because, you know, each episode so far has been about a topic. And today was about all the topics. It was about, you know, the model itself. So these eight ways of well-being. And so the challenge is really to reflect on your own life and see, you know, where your own well-being strengths and challenges are. And I liked how you said, you know, could I turn this knob and what kind of impact would it have? Which knobs of these eight, which ones could you turn, do you think, that might have the biggest impact on your life? And just, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to dial it all the way up, but just make a little tweak, yep. Right? Maybe make a little tweak in a couple, but do that reflection.
All right. So, that's it for this episode. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn. If you have any questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.